listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles. So much of our popular culture is based on cultural icons, superstars of the arts, industry, government, and literature. Often their deeds have morphed into legends, been blown out of proportion, and clouded over by writers who imagined and reimagined lives and accomplishments. The result often leaves us with very little based on actual fact. Today, the Book Report spotlights a fascinating group of new titles. Unlike others, these books offer balanced, factual accounts of real people and their legacies. My guest today, Tom Tidwell, Chief of the U.S. Forest Service, brings us up to date on a cultural icon loved by all. You'll want to hear the next chapter of his story, so stay tuned as we turn to page one of the Book Report. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee is an iconic novel, indeed one of the most beloved books of the 20th century. But for the last 50 years, the novel's celebrated author has been elusive. Journalists have trekked to her hometown of Monroeville, Alabama, trying and failing to get an interview. But in 2001, Lee, known to her friends as Nell, and her sister Alice opened their door to Chicago Tribune journalist Marja Mills. In 2004, Mills actually moved into the house next door to the sisters. She spent the next 18 months there, sharing coffee and trips to the laundromat, going out for catfish suppers with the sister, and exploring Lower Alabama with the Lees' inner circle of friends. The Mockingbird Next Door is the story of Mills' friendship with the Lees sisters. There is some controversy now surrounding the book, whether or not it was actually sanctioned by the sisters, but it is being much discussed. So, the Book Report begins with this preview, performed by Amy Lynn Stewart.
It's Harper Lee's hometown. We know she doesn't give interviews, but I think it's worth going there anyway. Enough said. A couple of weeks earlier, the Chicago Public Library had chosen the elusive author's To Kill a Mockingbird as the first selection in its One Book, One Chicago program. The idea was to get Chicagoans in every corner of the city reading and discussing the same book. It didn't hurt that To Kill a Mockingbird happened to be the favorite of Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley, as he told me a couple of months earlier for a story I wrote about his reading habits. That he was a reader at all surprised some folks. His press conferences were hard to follow. He didn't necessarily exit the same sentences he entered. But he loved books, and he especially loved To Kill a Mockingbird. In that, he was part of a phenomenon that began in 1960 and continues to this day. When the novel was published in July of that year, Harper Lee was a few months past her 34th birthday. From the beginning, Lee was a collection of contradictions. She was an Alabama native whose love of the state's back roads was matched only by her love of New York City streets. Her public shyness masked a wicked wit. During the publicity engagements for the novel's publication, when she wasn't averting her gaze, her dark eyes could alternate between a penetrating stare and a mischievous gleam. She was a distinctive blend of engaging and elusive. Lee labored for several years to produce the novel. She coaxed the story out of a Royal Manual typewriter in her small Manhattan cold water flat and on visits home. Atticus Finch is a principled attorney and the widowed father of two children. As the novel begins, his tomboy daughter, Scout, is about to turn 6. Her older brother, Jem, is almost 10. With their father, they endure the suspicion and outright hatred directed at Atticus when he defends Tom Robinson, a black man falsely accused of raping a white woman, Mayella Ewell, in their segregated town. In the novel's climactic scene, Bob Ewell, father of Mayella, comes after the children. Boo Radley, the neighborhood recluse who has frightened and fascinated the children in equal measure, saves them. Through the experiences of Scout, Jem, and their best friend Dill, Lee paints a vivid picture of small-town childhood in the segregated South. She also explores complex themes in the lives of her characters, from mental illness to addiction, racism, and the limitations society imposed on women. the story of small-town childhood and racial injustice in Depression-era Alabama, garnered glowing reviews and stayed on the bestseller list for nearly 2 years. In 1961, Lee won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. The Academy Award-winning 1962 film version of the novel, starring Gregory Peck, became a classic in its own right. It was a stunning debut. With time, Lee's novel became something more, a national touchstone and a culture becoming ever more fragmented. In a 1991 survey, the Library of Congress asked readers which book most influenced their lives. Only the Bible outranked To Kill a Mockingbird. It has sold an estimated 40 million copies or more and been translated into 36 languages, from Swedish to Urdu. It is required reading for at least 70% of U.S. high school students. The novel became a classic at the same time as it defied Mark Twain's definition of one: a book people praise and don't read. References to the work appear in movies, on television, in countless other books, and in comic strips, cartoons, and lyrics. People cite the novel as the reason they became writers or lawyers. The characters' unusual names have a comfortable familiarity, even to those who haven't read the novel in years, or perhaps never did. Atticus Finch, Scout, Boo Radley. The unusual names from Depression-era Alabama now populate the glossy pages of People and Us Weekly, as celebrities, as well as plenty of regular folks, name their children Harper, Atticus, or Scout. As the novel's cultural influence grew, so did Lee's mystique. A few years after the book was published, she essentially stopped giving interviews. The second novel she had once discussed never appeared. Her rare public appearances made headlines. Her speeches, when she did accept an occasional award, usually consisted of two words: thank you.
We've just heard The Mockingbird Next Door, Life with Harper Lee by Marja Mills. They were the Princess Dianas of their day, perhaps the most photographed and talked about young royals of the early 20th century. The four captivating Russian Grand Duchesses, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia Romanov. They were much admired for their happy dispositions, their looks, and their privileged lifestyle. Over the years, the story of the four Romanov sisters and their tragic end in 1918 seemed to have become myth. Now, in Helen Rappaport's The Romanov Sisters, The Lost Lives of the Daughters of Nicholas and Alexandra, readers are treated to a treasure trove of diaries and letters from the Grand Duchesses to their friends and family. We learn they were intelligent, sensitive, and perceptive witnesses to the dark turmoil within their immediate family and the ominous approach of the Russian Revolution. Shay Sons narrates.
In June, the staterooms located on the ground floor of the Alexander Palace were opened to the public after a careful inventory had been made of all their contents. People paid their 15 kopecks to enter and gawp, not at what they had anticipated would be the lavish style in which their former czar had lived, but rather in disbelief that such a homespun environment could have been the residence of the last czar of all the Russias. The interiors were unexpectedly modest by former imperial standards, no grander, perhaps, than those of a public library or a museum in the capital, or the country house of a moderately well-off gentleman. But for the Romanov family, the Alexander Palace had been a much-loved home. Dutiful members of the newly liberated proletariat, munching apples and caviar sandwiches, sometimes joined by a few intrepid foreign tourists, were encouraged to visit on Sundays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, making sure first to don the ugly but obligatory felt overshoes to protect the beautiful waxed parquet floors from damage. After doing so, they would be ushered through the imperial apartments to an accompanying and frequently contemptuous account of their former occupants. The well-drilled official guides did their best to decry the decidedly bourgeois tastes of Russia's last czar and his wife. The old-fashioned Art Nouveau-style furniture, the cheap outmoded oleographs and sentimental pictures, the English wallpaper, the profusion of knick-knacks scattered around on every available surface, predominantly factory-made goods of the most ordinary kind, reminded visitors of the typical parlor of an English or American boarding house or a second-class Berlin restaurant. The family themselves were dismissed in the glib phrases of Soviet speak as a historical irrelevance. As visitors were conducted from room to room, their doorways guarded by waxwork models of the scarlet and gold liveried real-life footmen who had once stood there, they could not avoid an increasing sense of Nicholas II not as the despotic ruler painted to them, but rather as a dull family man who had crammed his study and library, where he received his ministers on matters of important state business, with photographs of his children at every stage of their development from babyhood to adulthood. Children with dogs, on ponies, in the snow, by the seaside. A happy family smiling to the camera for homemade photographs taken on the box brownies that they took with them everywhere. Even in his private study, the Tsar had a table and chair where his invalid son could sit with him when he was working. This, the hub of a now-defunct Tsarist power, could not have appeared more unremarkable, more domestic and child-friendly. Was it really the last home of Nicholas the Bloody? The Tsar and Tsaritsa's suite of interconnecting private rooms further testified to their three consuming passions: each other, their children, and their devout religious faith. Their overcrowded bedroom, with its English chintz wallpaper and curtains, was more Russian Orthodox shrine than boudoir. Two modest single iron bedsteads, of the kind found in second-rate hotels, as one American visitor observed in 1934, stood pushed together in a heavily curtained alcove, every inch of wall space behind which was crammed from floor to ceiling with religious images, crucifixes, and pathetic cheap little tin icons. On every shelf and tabletop in her private sitting room, the Tsaritsa had set out yet more knickknacks and photographs of her children and her darling Nikki. Personal possessions were few and surprisingly trivial. Useful domestic items such as a gold thimble, sewing materials and embroidery scissors, as well as cheap toys and trinkets, a china bird and a pincushion made like a shoe, the kind of things that one of the children might have given her. At the far end of the corridor, toward the gardens, the cupboards in Nicholas's dressing room still held his neatly pressed uniforms, and nearby, the great library of glass-fronted bookcases was full of carefully ordered French, English, and German books bound in fine Moroccan leather, of the kind that he often sat and read aloud to his family in the evenings. Visitors were often taken aback by what greeted them in the mountain hall beyond. This, one of the palace's formal parade rooms, had instead served as a downstairs playroom for the Tsarevich Alexei. In the center of this elegant hall of colored marbles, caryatids, and mirrors, a large wooden slide, or American glide, on which the children of previous Tsars had happily played, still took pride of place, along with Alexei's three favorite toy motor cars.
That was The Romanov Sisters by Helen Rappaport. Tom Tidwell has spent 33 years in the Forest Service. He served in a variety of positions at all levels of the agency, including as district ranger, forest supervisor, and legislative affairs specialist in the Washington office. In 2009, after being named chief of the U.S. Forest Service, Tom set about implementing the secretary's vision for America's forests. Under his leadership, the Forest Service is restoring healthy, resilient forest and grassland ecosystems that can sustain the benefits that Americans get from their wildlands, including plentiful supplies of clean water, abundant habitat for wildlife and fish, and renewable supplies of wood and energy. Of course, our national parks and forests are at risk from the effects of climate change. Tom is leading the way in forging a national response. The Forest Service is working with states, tribes, private landowners, and other partners to restore our ecosystems. Today, we'll speak with Tom about something near and dear to his heart, the 70th birthday of Smokey the Bear. Smokey remains one of the most recognizable and beloved icons in our country's history, and of course, we all remember the Golden Book about Smokey. Since the wildfire prevention campaign first launched in 1944, the annual number of acres lost to wildfires has actually decreased from 22 million to an average of 6.7 million today. Welcome, Tom. We're honored to have you with us on the Book Report today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for taking out some time to help us share a very important message from Smokey Bear.
All right. So first, we have to settle a raging controversy. Is it Smokey the Bear or Smokey Bear?
It's Smokey Bear. The campaign started in 1944, when it was decided to use a bear, a forest animal, to be able to convey the message about wildfire prevention. But then in the 50s, there was a very popular song that was created, and the artist used in the lyrics, they used Smokey the Bear just so it would stay in rhythm with the music. But what's even more important, I mean, it's great to have this discussion about Smokey's real name, but it really doesn't matter. Whether it's Smokey Bear or Smokey the Bear, what's important is what almost all Americans recognize, that when Smokey says only you can prevent wildfires, it's something that has still resonates with close to 96% of Americans recognize Smokey and his message.
Right. Do we actually know the writer who coined the phrase? It's so iconic.
We actually do know the individual. It started back in 47, and it was at that time, it was only you can prevent forest fires. And then in 2001, we changed it to only you can prevent wildfires, just so it's more relevant, because we get wildfires not only in our forest environment, but definitely in our prairies, our grasslands, and brushlands of this country. And so that's been the only change. But when it comes down to it, between forest fires and wildfires, they're really the same thing. And so the message has been very, very consistent over the last 70 years.
You know, I was fascinated to know that Smokey's actual beginning had something to do with World War II.
Yes, it did. It goes back to back in the early 40s, or back in 1942, when the war got started there on the West Coast. There was a concern about the potential for the enemy to start wildfires on the West Coast, to not only burn our forests, but also to divert our soldiers away from the war effort, because we'd have to deal with the wildfires here in the country. Where that never, ever came about, but it increased the concern. And back then, we were already having a lot of wildfires on the landscape to begin with. So it helped kind of form an urgency about to do a better job, to increase the awareness, and to ask all of us to do a better job to prevent wildfires.
Right.
What's really interesting is that even back in the 40s, 9 out of 10 wildfires were human-caused. And over Smokey's campaign, it's been very successful. We've significantly reduced the number of wildfires each year. That ratio still holds. So even today, nearly 9 out of 10 fires are human-caused.
Right. You know, Smokey, of course, was an actual bear who was injured in a New Mexico fire and then sent to the National Zoo for recuperation and fame and fortune. How many years did he actually live in the zoo?
Well, he was sent back to the zoo in 1950 when he was as a cub, and he became the living symbol for Smokey Bear until 1976, when the bear died at the National Zoo.
Hmm. And Smokey has his own zip code?
Yes, Smokey does have his own zip code. It's 20252. And so if anyone wants to send Smokey a message, that mail makes it to the U.S. Forest Service office in Washington, D.C., and every one of his messages is read, and we try to respond to all of those. But also, Smokey Bear is also on social media today. He's on the web at smokeybear.com. He's on Facebook at hashtag SmokeyBearHug. And that's one of the great parts of the latest public service campaign, is that if you want to, you can go to hashtag SmokeyBearHug and get your own hug from Smokey Bear when you do something that's helpful to prevent wildfires.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen a lot of bus advertisements about the Smokey hugs.
Yeah, it's another great idea of the Ad Council to be able to keep Smokey relevant and to continue with his image of being this very friendly, lovable bear, but at the same time that has a very serious message. And so I think that it's great with the public service announcements where Smokey, when he sees somebody doing something right, taking steps to put their campfire out, doing things to keep their trailer chains off the pavement so they don't accidentally create a spark and start a fire. Then Smokey walks up and gives them a hug. And I think it's just a very powerful way to reinforce taking personal responsibility for your actions, and then you get a bear hug.
You know, Tom, I'm not sure most folks understand that there is a difference between the National Park Service and the U.S. Forest Service. Can you tell us what the differences are?
Well, the differences are two agencies. The National Park Service manages our national parks throughout the country with a mission that's really around preservation and interpretation where folks can come enjoy the natural settings in our national parks. Our national forests, where we have 193 million acres in 44 different states, along with Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, the national forests were set up for multiple use. So on your national forests, not only can you enjoy all the recreational activities you can imagine, but also the areas are managed, you know, for grazing production. We have mining activities. We have a lot of all the different uses on our national forests, including commodity productions, say with wood. And most of our timber harvest that occurs today is all designed to be able to make our forests more resilient, especially to wildfire and insect and disease. So we're focusing our efforts to thin out our forests so that they continue to provide the full mix of benefits, with the number one being clean air, clean water, wildlife habitat, recreational settings that so many of Americans really enjoy and depend on.
What would you say to folks who claim that forest fires are simply a part of the natural chain of events?
Well, definitely fire is part of the ecosystem. And we get a lot of lightning fires, which is part of the natural process. And some of those fires, especially in the backcountry, are managed for resource benefits. But when it comes to Smokey's message, it's focused on nearly 9 out of 10 fires are caused by humans, caused by people. That's not a natural process. That's what we really want to focus on, is reducing the tens of thousands of fires. In fact, we're still having over 60,000 fires every year that are started by humans. Many times, those are the fires that become very large, the fires that burn into our communities where we lose homes, and yes, that from time to time have the tragic loss of life. That's what we want to focus on, is reducing the number of human-caused fires.
Right. So any final thoughts about Smokey Bear?
Well, Smokey's been doing a great job for 70 years, and we just need to continue to find ways for all of us to do our job, to be responsible for our actions. And we have a great opportunity right now with Smokey's 70th birthday that we all can send Smokey Bear a birthday present by making sure we're doing everything we can to prevent wildfires.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. It was so wonderful to have you with us today on the Book Report.
Well, thank you, and thank you for everything you're doing to help us get Smokey's message out.
All right, bye now.
Goodbye.
Part biography, part cultural history, The Creation of Anne Boleyn by Susan Bordo is a fascinating reconstruction of Anne's life and an illuminating look at her place in our popular imagination. Why has Anne always been so compelling? Why has she inspired such extreme reactions? Perhaps the most provocative questions concern her death more than her life. How could Henry have ordered the execution of someone he had loved so fiercely? Drawing on scholarship and critical analysis, Bordo probes the complexities of one of history's most infamous relationships. Bordo also shows how generations of biographers, novelists, and filmmakers have cast Anne in a variety of roles: whore, martyr, feminist icon, and everything in between. Barbara Rosenblatt performs this lively book, which detours off the well-trodden paths of what we think we know, to present the human being behind the competing mythologies.
Why is Anne Boleyn so fascinating? Maybe we don't have to go any further than the obvious. The story of her rise and fall is as elementally satisfying, and script-wise not very different from, a lifetime movie. A long-suffering postmenopausal wife, an unfaithful husband, and a clandestine affair with a younger, sexier woman. A moment of glory for the mistress, then lust turned to loathing, plotting, and murder as the cycle comes full circle. As Irene Goodman writes, quote, Anne's life was not just an important historical event. It was also the stuff of juicy tabloid stories. It has sex, adultery, pregnancy, scandal, divorce, royalty, glitterati, religious quarrels, and larger-than-life personalities. If Anne lived today, she would have been the subject of lurid tabloid headlines. Randy King dumps hag for trophy wife. But Anne hasn't always been seen as a skanky schemer. For supporters of Catherine of Aragon, she was worse, a cold-hearted murderess. For Catholic propagandists, such as Nicholas Sander, she was a six-fingered, jaundiced-looking erotomaniac who slept with butlers, chaplains, and half of the French court. For Elizabethan admirers, she was the unsung hero of the Protestant Reformation. For the Romantics, particularly in painting, she was the hapless victim of a king's tyranny, a view that gets taken up in the earliest film versions of Anne, Ernst Lubitsch's silent Anna Boleyn and Alexander Korda's The Private Life of Henry VIII. In post-war movies and on television, Anne has been animated by the rebellious spirit of the 60s, Anne of the Thousand Days, the mean girl and the power feminist celebration of female aggression and competitiveness of the 90s, the other Boleyn girl, and the third-wave feminism of a new generation of Anne worshippers, inspired by Natalie Dormer's brainy seductress of the Tudors, to see in Anne a woman too smart, sexy, and strong for her own time, unfairly vilified for her defiance of 16th-century norms of wifely obedience and silence. Henry may have tried to write his second wife out of history, but Anne Boleyn has been too strong for him in the many guises she has assumed over the centuries. One goal of this book is to follow the cultural career of these mutating Annes, from the poisonous putain created by the Spanish ambassador Eustace Chapuis, a highly biased portrayal that became history for many later writers, to the radically revisioned Anne of the internet generation. I'm not such a postmodernist, however, that I'm content to just write a history of competing narratives. I'm fascinated by their twists and turns, but even more fascinated by the real Anne, who has not been quite as disappeared as Henry wanted. Like Marilyn Monroe in our own time, she is an enigma who is hard to keep one's hands off of. Just as men dreamed of possessing her in the flesh, writers can't resist the desire to solve the mysteries of how she came to be, to reign, to perish. I'm no exception. I have my own theories, and I won't hide them. There are so many big questions that remain unanswered that this book would be very unsatisfying if I did not attempt to address them. Perhaps the biggest question concerns Henry more than Anne herself. How could he do it? The execution of a queen was extreme and shocking, even to Anne's enemies. They may have believed Anne guilty of adultery and treason, and Henry may have too, but even so, it still does not explain Anne's execution. Eleanor of Aquitaine had been banished for the same crimes. Why did Anne have to die? The answer, I believe, is psychological as well as political. To find it, we have to venture with caution, for his was an era that lived largely by roles rather than by introspection, into Henry's psyche.
That was The Creation of Anne Boleyn by Susan Bordeaux. Born in the same year as the Battle of Gettysburg, Henry Ford died 2 years after the atomic bombs fell. His life personified the tremendous technological changes during that time span. Growing up as a Michigan farm boy with a bone-deep loathing of farming, Ford intuitively saw the advantages of internal combustion. Resourceful and fearless, he built his first gasoline engine out of scavenged industrial scraps. It was the size of a sewing machine. Richard Snow's I Invented the Modern Age, The Rise of Henry Ford and the Most Important Car Ever Made, vividly shows Ford using his innate mechanical abilities, hard work, and radical imagination to transform American industry. When Ford first unveiled the Model T, it took 12 and a half hours to build one car. A little more than a decade later, it took exactly 1 minute. In making his car so quickly and so cheaply that even his own workers could easily afford it, Ford created the cycle of consumerism we still inhabit today. Sean Renette narrates.
Upstairs, the beds were made with fresh linen. Out back stood the stacks of firewood, just as they had in his boyhood. The reservoirs of all the kerosene lamps were full, their wicks trimmed and ready for the match. Ford had got more things than he'd needed to furnish his farmhouse. He kept the overflow in his office until 1922, when one of his tractor operations moved, leaving behind it an empty building that covered 3 acres. With this repository available, the car maker's ambitions expanded beyond the home of his youth to encompass the world of his youth. Once again, his agents went out, this time in their hundreds. They were, said the boss, to bring back a complete series of every article ever used or made in America from the days of the first settlers down to the present time. The stream began to flow in. Bird cages and settees and patent washboards, carriages, rifles, apple parers, reapers and binders, and the lunch wagon where Ford had grabbed meals when he was working for Detroit Edison back in the 90s. Ford accumulated enough objects, as it turned out, to entirely furnish, from weather vane and lightning rod to mantel clock and furnace, 107 buildings. At the time, those buildings were living out their lives far from Ford and far from one another. One was a courthouse in Illinois where the young Abraham Lincoln had argued cases. Two were Georgia slave cabins. One, the brick storefront where Wilbur and Orville Wright sold bicycles while they conducted their momentous experiments. The homely items Ford had collected still radiated the residual warmth of life from a vanished time. But the signals they sent out were faint, diffuse, cluttered. Put them in a landscape where men and women had used them, though, and their feeble, dissonant notes might become a powerful harmony. Beyond the airport Ford had just built in Dearborn, it was 1926 now, lay a tract of land where nothing much at all had ever happened. He would, he decided, inject these anonymous acres with history by building on them a monument to the past, a village that would preserve the American life as lived of what he called a saner and sweeter time. The man incubating this plan had done more than anyone else alive to annihilate that life, and he found much of its sweet sanity repellent. Everyone today knows his name, but very few could attribute more than one statement to him, which is that history was bunk. The bunk part he perceived in history may have been the sheer mass of it. All those names he had to learn, all those treaties and tariffs and boundary disputes. Ford always liked to see the thing itself. Years later, some of his old lieutenants would say he couldn't read a blueprint. He could, and competently, too. But it is perfectly true that he would far rather see the objects encoded in the cool white lines. His sense of what was sound engineering transmitted itself most surely through his fingertips. So it was with the past. Ford wanted to be able to handle it, to walk inside it and look around. He bought the Illinois courthouse and moved it to Dearborn, to the town he had named Greenfield Village, after his wife's birthplace. He bought the Wright Brothers cycle shop and moved it there, too, and to keep it company, the carpentry Queen Anne house the brothers grew up in. He brought Thomas Edison's laboratory from Menlo Park, New Jersey, along with a dozen freight carloads of Jersey dirt so it could stand amid the snails and fungi it had always known, and the boarding house where Edison's hard-pressed staff hadn't slept enough. The Edison Illuminating Company and its dynamos took up residence near Noah Webster's home.
That was I Invented the Modern Age by Richard Snow. Wilbur and Orville Wright were two of the greatest innovators in history. Together, they solved the centuries-old riddle of powered, heavier-than-air flight. Glenn Hammond Curtis was the most talented machinist of his day. He became the fastest man alive when he perfected the motorcycle, then turned his eyes towards the skies to become the fastest man aloft. Sadly, the Wrights and Curtis had a poisonous rivalry and a patent war so powerful it shaped aviation in its early years and drove one of the three men to his grave. Birdman, the Wright brothers, Glenn Curtis, and The Battle to Control the Skies by Lawrence Goldstone is a thrilling ride through flight's wild early years and a surprising look at the battle that defined an era of American innovation. Jonathan Fried narrates.
Despite Langley's success, Octave Chanute continued to maintain that development of a successful glider was the real key to flight. He had also decided to become an active participant in the research. 1 month after Langley's aerodrome corkscrewed down the Potomac, Chanute set up a camp in the sand dunes on remote, windswept Miller Beach on the shores of Lake Michigan, just east of Gary, Indiana. Unlike Langley, for whom a breeze of 5 miles per hour was sufficient to deter a launch, Chanute, as would the Wrights 4 years hence, wanted wind. "No bird soars in a calm," Wilbur would observe. As Chanute later recounted, Miller Beach was specifically chosen because the gliders would need a soft place on which to alight, a dry and loose sandhill, and there ought to be no bushes or trees to run into. Our party found such sandhills, almost a desert, in which we pitched our tent, about 30 miles east of Chicago. As had Langley, he had recruited a team of talented younger men, but Chanute's four assistants would have the freedom to pursue their own ideas. One of the four was a doctor, as Chanute anticipated a number of crashes during the tests, although medical expertise turned out not to be necessary. They would also, in theory, receive credit when the ideas worked, but that was to become a matter of contention as events progressed. The most important of those assistants was Augustus Herring, returned from his misadventures at the Smithsonian. If Chanute bore Herring any ill will, he never showed it. Herring brought with him his Lilienthal glider, but neither he nor Chanute intended to spend a great deal of time on what both considered by then only a formative technology. When the glider was damaged in a crash, they decided not to repair it. "This decision," Chanute wrote, "was most unfortunately justified on the 10th of the succeeding August, when Herr Lilienthal met his death while experimenting with a machine based on the same principle." Instead, Chanute set Herring to work on his own concept of a ladder glider, a stack of up to 7 airfoils. For this and any other arrangement, Chanute adapted Lilienthal's launching technique. The operator stands on the hillside. He raises up the apparatus, which is steadied by a companion, and quickly slips under and within the machine. He faces the wind. This wind buffets the wings from side to side and up and down, so that he has much difficulty in obtaining a poise. This is finally accomplished by bracing the crosspiece of the machine's frame against his back and depressing the front edge of the wings so that they will be struck from above by the wind. His armpits rest on a pair of horizontal bars, and he grasps a pair of vertical bars with his hands. He is in no way attached to the machine, so that he may disengage himself instantly should anything go wrong. Then, still facing dead into the wind, he takes 1 or 2, but never more than 4 running steps forward, raising up the front edge of the apparatus at the last moment, and the air claims him. Then he sails forward into the wind on a generally descending course. The Miller Beach expedition had its share of failed experiments. Chanute's ladder glider was an early casualty, but its one success would change aviation. A collaboration by Herring and Chanute resulted in what was later referred to as the two-surface glider, described as the most significant and influential aircraft of the pre-Wright era. The apparatus was bifoil, essentially a Hargrave box kite with two sides removed, the two parallel surfaces held in place by Pratt trussing, a method Chanute had used often in bridge building. The Pratt truss was developed in 1844 and used when bridges were constructed of iron rather than wood.
We've just heard Birdmen by Lawrence Goldstone. Michael ranks off the edge of the map Marco Polo, Captain Cook, and nine other travelers and explorers that pushed the boundaries of the known world, looks at 11 great explorers. Some traveled for religious piety, such as Ibn Battuta, who traveled from North Africa to Indonesia in the 1300s, visiting every Islamic pilgrimage site between, and along the way, he counseled more than 30 heads of state. Others traveled for profit, such as Ferdinand Magellan, who wanted to consolidate Spain's holdings on the spice trade. Still others traveled for discovery, like Ernest Shackleton, who led 24 men to the bottom of the world in an attempt to cross Antarctica on foot. Whatever their reason for discovery, these explorers pushed the limits of human achievement, and their stories, performed by Kevin Pierce, make for an entertaining read.
What is the purpose of exploration in the 21st century, when so much of the globe has been discovered, mapped, photographed, and cataloged? What can be gained by undertaking such a dangerous journey when no new information can be obtained? In order to understand the motivations that compel explorers to put themselves in mortal danger to discover new lands, this book will look at the lives and journeys of the 11 greatest explorers in history, some who explored purely for the sake of adventure, and others from the Middle Ages who stepped into unknown lands when little of the world was mapped and even less understood. It will look at their individual lives and circumstances, which inspired their desire to travel. Ferdinand Magellan saw an opportunity to raise Portugal from a small coastal state to a massive power by taking control of the 16th century global spice trade in his circumnavigation of the globe. Ernest Shackleton sought honor for England and himself in embarking on a dangerous journey to lead a team of men to cross the Antarctic continent. This book will also consider the historical conditions that compelled these explorers to seek out new lands and that made their journeys possible. Marco Polo was only able to travel overland from Italy through Central Asia and into the court of Kublai Khan due to the recent Mongol conquests that created peace and stability all along the thousands of miles of the Silk Road. Nestorian monk Robin Barsauma completed the same journey at the same time and under the same Mongolian political protection. The explorers in this book were chosen for their specific qualities, broken down into four characteristics.
We've just heard Off the Edge of the Map by Michael Rank. Kim Philby was one of the greatest spies in history, a brilliant, charming man who rose to head Britain's counterintelligence against the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War, while he was secretly working for the enemy. No one thought they knew Philby like Nicholas Elliott, Philby's best friend and fellow officer in MI6. The two men attended the same schools and belonged to the same exclusive clubs. Their friendship was cemented by wartime intelligence work and long nights of drinks and revelry. But as Ben McIntyre writes in A Spy Among Friends, Kim Philby and the Great Betrayal, every word Elliot breathed to Philby was transmitted back to Moscow. In America, Philby had another powerful friend whom he betrayed, James Jesus Angleton, the crafty paranoid head of CIA counterintelligence. Angleton's and Elliot's unwitting disclosures helped Philby sink almost every important Anglo-American spy operation for 20 years, leading countless operatives to their doom. Even as the web of suspicion closed around him, his two friends never abandoned him until it was too late. The stunning truth of his betrayal had devastating consequences on these two men and on the intelligence services he left crippled in his wake. The reviewer from the Times of London had this to say: McIntyre's focus on friendship brings an intimacy to this book missing from cardboard stereotypes that populate spy novels and conventional espionage histories. I'm not a lover of spy novels, yet I adored this book. John Lee narrates.
Nicholas Elliot arranged to meet Van at Ascot, and over drinks mentioned that he thought he might like to join the intelligence service. Sir Robert Vansittart smiled and replied, "I am relieved you have asked me for something so easy." "So, that was that," Elliot wrote many years later. The old boy's recruitment network had worked perfectly. Nicholas Elliot was not obviously cut out to be a spy. His academic record was undistinguished. He knew little about the complexities of international politics, let alone the dexterous and dangerous game being played by MI6 in the run-up to war. Indeed, he knew nothing whatsoever about espionage, but he thought spying sounded exciting and important and exclusive. Elliot was self-confident as only a well-bred, well-heeled young Etonian, newly graduated from Cambridge University, with all the right social connections, can be. He was born to rule, though he would never have expressed that belief so indelicately, and membership in the most selective club in Britain seemed like a good place to start doing so. The Elliots were part of the backbone of the empire. For generations, they had furnished military officers, senior clerics, lawyers, and colonial administrators who ensured that Britain continued to rule the waves, and much of the globe in between. One of Nicholas Elliot's grandfathers had been the Lieutenant Governor of Bengal, the other a senior judge. Like many powerful English families, the Elliots were also notable for their eccentricity. Nicholas's great-uncle Edgar famously took a bet with another Indian Army officer that he could smoke his height in cheroots every day for 3 months, then smoked himself to death in two. Great-aunt Blanche was said to have been crossed in love at the age of 26, and thereafter took to her bed, where she remained for the next 50 years. Aunt Nancy firmly believed that Catholics were not fit to own pets, since they did not believe animals had souls. The family also displayed a profound but frequently fatal fascination with mountain climbing. Nicholas's uncle, the Reverend Julius Elliot, fell off the Matterhorn in 1869, shortly after meeting Gustave Flaubert, who declared him the epitome of the English gentleman. Eccentricity is one of those English traits that look like frailty, but mask a concealed strength, individuality disguised as oddity. Towering over Nicholas's childhood was his father, Claude, a man of immovable Victorian principles and ferocious prejudices. Claude loathed music, which gave him indigestion, despised all forms of heating as effete, and believed that when dealing with foreigners, the best plan was to shout at them in English. Before becoming headmaster of Eton, Claude Elliot had taught history at Cambridge University, despite an ingrained distrust of academics and an aversion to intellectual conversation. The long university vacations gave him plenty of time for mountain climbing. He might have become the most celebrated climber of his generation, but for a kneecap broken by a fall in the Lake District, which prevented him from joining Mallory's Everest expedition. A dominating figure physically and psychologically, Claude was nicknamed the Emperor by the boys at Eton. Nicholas regarded his father with awed reverence. In return, Claude alternately ignored or teased his only child, believing, like many fathers of his time and class, that displaying affection would make his son soft, and quite possibly homosexual. Nicholas grew up convinced that Claude was highly embarrassed by my very existence. His mother avoided all intimate topics of conversation, according to her only son, including God, disease, and below the waist. The young Elliot was therefore brought up by a succession of nannies, and then shunted off to Durnford School in Dorset, a place with a tradition of brutality extreme even by the standards of British prep schools. Every morning the boys were made to plunge naked into an unheated pool for the pleasure of the headmaster, whose wife liked to read improving literature out loud in the evenings with her legs stretched out over two small boys, while a third tickled the soles of her feet. There was no fresh fruit, no toilets with doors, no restraint on bullying, and no possibility of escape. Today, such an institution would be illegal. In 1925, it was considered character-forming. Eliot left his prep school with the conviction that nothing as unpleasant could ever recur. An ingrained contempt for authority and a hardy sense of humor.
We've just heard A Spy Among Friends by Ben McIntyre. Readers, I hope you found this week's show an entertaining clarification of fact versus fiction. For news-making titles across the genres, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.